All right. With that, we'll call the first case this morning, which is Lyon Financial versus Illinois Paper, case number 12-2210. Ms. Babu?
May it please the court. My name is Deborah DeVassi Babu, and I represent the appellant Lyon Financial. Our case involves the enforceability of a contract provision that provides that Illinois Paper represents and warrants that all lease transactions presented to Lyon are valid and enforceable agreements. When the subject lease agreement ultimately was deemed to be void under the Illinois Municipal Code due to its term of 6 years instead of five, Lyon sued Illinois Paper for breach of contract for breach of that representation pursuant to the contract's indemnity clause. The lower court erroneously held that the provision was a representation of law that is unenforceable under Illinois law. The lower court also held that Lyon's claim was really a breach of warranty instead of a breach of contract claim. The lower court's order is an error for several reasons, particularly because Illinois Paper and Lyon contractually agreed and allocated the risk of the lease agreement's unenforceability to Illinois Paper. Here, Illinois Paper agreed to shoulder the burden of determining whether the lease agreement was enforceable. If the court affirms the lower court's ruling, it will create the unwanted ripple effect of undoing many other commercial transactions in which one party allocates a risk to another party. By way of example, if I were to purchase a municipal bond from an investment broker and the broker represents that the bond is enforceable, I then don't have the duty to go out and investigate and confirm that the bond in fact complies with the law. I can rely on the broker's representation since the broker has agreed to assume that contractual risk in determining what bonds are enforceable and made available on the open market.
It's pretty clear that the consequences of an affirmance are significant in this case, because if the rule that the district court applied here is in fact the correct one, it does upset established expectations based on contracts in all kinds of commercial paper transactions. As a national matter, to the extent that this decision would emanate from this court. And so I think it's important that we take this step by step. We do have a choice of law question in this case. The district court, as you noted, applied Illinois law, but the contract calls for Minnesota law to apply. So we're having to make that choice in the first instance and then predict what the Supreme Court of the state would do, and there isn't a lot of recent case law on this particular issue. For whatever reason, it seems to have eluded significant developments in the state courts, for lack of a better way to put it.
I agree with that, Your Honor. All of the cases in Minnesota provide that a representation of law is not enforceable in the context of fraud or an intentional misrepresentation. But there are no cases that provide a representation of law is not enforceable in the context of breach of contract or breach of warranty. The Parkside versus Lee case is a Minnesota Supreme Court case that that decided that a seller of real property who represented that a mobile home park complied with all applicable law was actually a representation of fact. The court did not state that if it had been a representation of law, it would not have been enforceable in the context of breach of contract. So I agree with Your Honor that there are no cases that really address the very point that's at issue in this case, whether or not a representation of law is enforceable in the context of breach of contract.
Well, there is one way to look at the representation in question in this case as a representation of fact, in the way that the Parkside case
yes,
did, because it was a very similar sort of contractual warranty in that case that all laws had been complied with, or that the property in question was in compliance with all laws, and that's very similar to what we have here, that the lease, the leases that would be tendered to your client would be valid and enforceable. It's the same sort of thing. So I guess there's one way to fit this into the Parkside case by construing it as a representation of fact. Are there any downsides to doing that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, I would actually say that the Parkside case, the representation would be representation that would appear to be closer to representation of law, because the representation actually said there's compliance with applicable zoning laws and all these other laws, state and local laws. The representation issue here is much broader than that. It just provides that the leases are valid and enforceable. And regardless of whether the enforceability of the leases turns on an issue of fact or an issue of law, the provision is broad enough to encompass all those instances.
In the Parkside case, wasn't what was really driving the decision the fact that it was kind of one-sided access to the information that was necessary to determine whether or not there was compliance? In other words, only one side had access to the facts in order to determine whether or not they were in compliance with the law. So wasn't that kind of a fact-based determination by the court?
I think so. I think you're correct, Your Honor. But as we noted, Corbin on contracts and Williston on contracts has addressed how a lot of courts, the line between issues of law and issues of fact are blurred, in part because the court wants to reach a certain conclusion. I mean, the Corbin on contracts indicates that sometimes the line's arbitrary, and, you know, to do equity to one party, sometimes the court will look at a representation and say, okay, this is a representation of fact so that it can be actionable. I mean, I would say that in Parkside, as I just stated, you know, that representation sounds like something that, at least in Illinois, would be closer to that of a representation of law. You have all these zoning cases in Illinois where one party represents to another the property complies with all applicable ordinances and zoning laws, and courts have held that that's a representation of law that's not actionable in fraud, not in breach of contract, but in fraud. But I think in part with Parkside, it was very clear that the seller had information, clearly knew that the water was unsanitary, on the property, intentionally did not reveal that information to the purchaser of the real estate, and the court found that there was a basis for that to be deemed a representation of fact rather than law so that it was actionable.
One of the other problems I have with that Parkside case, and it really literally is the only pronouncement that even comes close to this issue from the Minnesota Supreme Court, one of the other problems I have with it is that it really didn't give much treatment to this issue at all. I mean, it dealt with the issue in two sentences. And so it's very hard to rely on that as an authoritative analysis from the state's highest court of the intricacies of this issue. And it is, in my judgment, very intricate as a legal matter. So maybe if we could step back and talk about first principles, why should this category choice of whether this was a representation of fact or law make any difference in contract as opposed to tort? We know it makes a difference in tort, right, and there are reasons for that. And so, you know, perhaps we can talk a little bit about whether those reasons have equal force in the contract setting.
Sure. The lower court at the oral argument on the motion to reconsider had asked that very question. Why would we allow a tortfeasor the ability to escape any liability if it's a representation of fact, whereas if that same representation was involved in a breach of contract action, why would that party have any liability? And I think the answer is the contractual allocation of risk. I mean, if the parties agree, you know, I'm going to undertake the burden of determining whether a lease agreement's enforceable under the law or under facts, and, you know, you're the contracting party and you rely on that and decide, okay, then I'm not going to undertake that investigation and incur those transactional costs, that's something that court should enforce. I mean, in a fraud situation, one party is deceiving another and, you know, obviously not providing information or intentionally omitting information. And I think, in part, the rule that representation of law are not actionable in fraud tries to protect the courts, really, because otherwise you're going to have all these plaintiffs claiming fraud, trying to seek punitive damages for what really is a breach of contract action, and it could really flood the courts with cases in which evidence of oral representations is going to be at issue, whereas in a written contract, you have the representations right there. The parties have allocated their responsibilities from the onset of the relationship as opposed to afterwards trying to say, I relied on that representation, and it ended up being false.
Well, I guess I'm not so much asking this question from the same standpoint that the district court did, in the sense that the law ought to treat con artists more severely than contract breachers. I don't think that's really the crux of the issue here. And you raise valid points about the difficulties of sorting out these claims for the courts and making the category choice. I think those are valid considerations, but the really, from my standpoint, looking at this as an appellate judge, the concern is really more fundamental than that, which is to say, what is the source of the duty in a tort case, a fraud case, as opposed to a contract case, and how does that determine what the legal rules should be,
well,
if you get what I'm driving at?
I think I do, and if I'm not answering your question, I apologize. I think that these categories, representations of law, representations of fact, they don't really make sense in the context of breach of contract. And that's really what the Corbett on contracts and Williston on contracts is really driving at, that we cited to in our brief. It may have made sense when the rule first arose. I think it was in the 1800s, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense right now. And actually, this court in the Atwell case had indicated that that maxim that all parties are presumed to know the law is kind of an ancient one, that it's not really practical anymore. It doesn't really make sense. So I would say that in the context of breach of contract, these categories, they really don't make a lot of sense. I hope I've answered your question. I see I'm going into
Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is the issue that's also prominent in this case, which is the issue of reliance and the reasons for the reliance and change of position and reliance on the misrepresentation in fraud law and tort law, and whether there is a similar requirement in breach of contract, certainly not in breach of contract, in breach of warranty law historically or at the present time, and if so, what the reason for that requirement is and whether it holds in the contract setting.
Well, you know, in the briefs we argued that reliance is not an element of breach of warranty under Minnesota law. We cited to the Peterson case, which is the Supreme Court case on that. And basically, now that case was decided in the context of the UCC, but the court did not limit the requirements or the elements of reliance to just UCC cases. So I would say that
Peterson case was really all about categories of damages and the measure of damages and whether there's a comparative component to the damages calculation in a breach of warranty case. And so it was heavily focused on that issue and whether the plaintiff's misconduct or negligence should be compared against that of the breach of warranty. And I have a real difficult time, I have to confess, in wrapping my mind around the idea of comparison of negligence in the context of breach of warranty. I don't get that rule, but that apparently is a Minnesota rule. But that's what that case was mostly focused on, so I don't see that as helping one side or the other in this case.
Well,
on our own.
That opinion did indicate when typically breach of warranty a cause of action arise, and they usually are in a case of defective goods, which is exactly why we indicated we did not think it was appropriate for the lower court to categorize our breach of contract claim as a breach of warranty claim. I agree with you that the focus of the opinion is more on damages, but the court does state what the elements are for breach of warranty.
Does it really make a difference whether we classify this as breach of contract or breach of warranty? Shouldn't they be the same thing? A warranty is part of the contract?
I think, Your Honor, my time is up, but I'll try to wrap up the thought. Reliance, well, I think it's exactly what Your Honor has identified. Reliance is not an element of breach of contract. Reliance, we believe, is not also an element for breach of warranty.
The Eighth Circuit seems to think it is in Minnesota. What do we do with the Hendricks case?
Well, in Hendricks, obviously the Eighth Circuit is trying to predict what the Supreme Court would hold, and I would say, you know, that they've tried to do that, but that's not necessarily a binding.
It's not, but it's something we have to contend with if we disagree. We're in conflict with the Eighth Circuit, and that's the federal circuit that reviews more of Minnesota's cases than ours.
I understand.
Why did they get it wrong?
Well,
I'll give you more time, by the way, so I kept you up there.
I think that regardless, I guess, if reliance is an element, so let's assume reliance is an element, a breach of warranty in Minnesota, I think that Lyon could have relied on the representation, regardless of whether it was a representation of law.
Okay, this begs the question of what kind of reliance is important in a warranty action.
Well, I would think it would be reasonable reliance, as you know, as it typically is. And if the contract provides that Illinois Paper is representing that the lease agreement is valid and enforceable, Lyon was able to rely on that representation because the parties decided that burden was going to be shouldered by Illinois Paper.
I guess I'm talking about the distinction that New York draws between reliance on the promise. In other words, as a part of the bargain, that we agree to undertake this duty of due diligence on the leases and relieve you of it, and that's the sort of reliance that's at issue. In other words, it's contract formation reliance as opposed to contract performance reliance in each individual presentation of the lease.
So, if I'm understanding correctly, that the representation was that Illinois Paper made was crucial to
part of the bargain
to Lyon accepting the terms of the contract and entering into the contract.
Right.
I would.
Is
agree
that a way
that.
To thread the needle?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Stace.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Andy Stays. I'm here on behalf of Illinois Paper. Judge Sykes, you asked an interesting question at the threshold, and that is, what is the source of the duty in a case like this? And the duty, as I understand the question in context, is to inform the other side about what the law is. There is no such source.
That's not what I'm driving at. What is the source of duty in tort, and what is the source of duty in contract?
Well, in terms of the contract,
a real basic question.
We start with the provisions of the contract, but it's not enough to say that because the contractual language has a term in it, that has forever and for all purposes allocated a burden.
Why not?
Because
that's what the parties bargained for.
Of course. But every contract has terms. That doesn't mean that the analysis begins and ends with just the existence of a term and that we then don't have to even look at that term to see if it's legally enforceable. Because if that's the case, all you have to do is put something... Well, let's assume that a contract says, I hereby warrant and guarantee that the murder-for-hire contract that you're about to enter is legal, and I'll indemnify you if it's not.
Okay, now, that's void against public policy. We don't have any public policy overlay here.
The contract in this case was void because it violated the Illinois Express statutory law.
How was the allocation of the burden of risk on that point void against public policy?
The contract
parties
itself...
just decided who was going to bear the risk of that condition.
They
put it on your client.
It gets back to the issue that everyone is charged with knowledge of the law.
That's a tort concept. It's not a contract concept.
Concept throughout the range of the law. That allocation has been made by every court in this nation, which says that you are responsible for determining the law, but what you're not responsible for.
In the fraud context, you can't rely on a representation of the law that's not justified for fraud purposes. That's not a concept that exists in contract law. The parties can allocate due diligence burdens in commercial transactions, and they do it all the time.
It has to do with facts, Judge, but
and it has to do with legal validity and enforceability of the commercial paper that's being transferred.
Well, Judge, in terms of, I think, one of the responses you heard about the duty was an illustration about a broker. And that's one of those exceptions to that general rule that when there's a fiduciary relationship, then you can allocate that burden to the fiduciary to tell you what the law is.
That's an exception to
the
tort
general, not a tort rule, to the general rule that every party is responsible for the law, and representations as to the law are simply no ground for relief. That's the words that the Minnesota courts use.
A contract case that says that.
Well, Judge, they don't say it's no ground for relief in a fraud case, but you know what? If you want to bring it as a warranty, come on down. They say it's no ground for relief.
In fraud cases.
Well,
there is no contract case that says that.
Well, the Parkside case does. The Parkside case starts out with...
that. What? The Parkside case has two sentences saying this is a representation of fact. They didn't analyze the issue, and they didn't even discuss why it was important.
Can I address the Parkside case just a little bit? Parkside began with the issue raised in terms of whether or not the warranty was actionable. And it was a contract case. It wasn't a fraud case. It was a contract based on the breach of a warranty within it. So the issue before that court, the Supreme Court, was, is it actionable? For that, the court looked to the next question, was, is it a representation of law or is it a representation of fact? It cited its prior decision in the PA case, which goes on endlessly talking about if it is a representation of law, it is not actionable. It is no ground for relief.
That's a fraud case.
Pardon me?
The PIA case was a fraud
relied
case.
On by the Supreme Court of Minnesota in a contract case, which makes is pretty compelling that the principle applies in contract cases as well. Now, in that case,
I think you're over-reading it, counsel. It's a two-sentence holding. They took the party's argument at face value without analyzing the premises of it and said, this is a representation of fact. So we don't even have to discuss why the categorization is important and whether it obtains in the contract setting. It's clearly, it was a very dismissive ruling.
It was dismissive because the facts were so clear in that case that it was a factual representation.
I get that. Once they said it's a representation of fact, they didn't have to grapple with the legal issues. So my point is that the Parkside case doesn't help either side here. It really stands for nothing that's important in this case in terms of predicting what the Supreme Court of Minnesota would do with this particular issue, which is squarely joined in this case, about whether this categorization is important in the contract or warranty setting.
What, Judge?
So maybe you want to deal with that as a matter of first principles.
Well, I'd at least like to get back to Parkside for 1 second. If the distinction between law and fact was meaningless in the contract setting, there would be no logical reason for the Supreme Court of a state to reach down and conduct that analysis and that analysis alone. I suppose they could have gone on to say that, you know what, the rule in Shelley's case doesn't apply here either.
Courts very often take the path of least resistance to deciding issues.
Exactly, and that's why they wouldn't raise up a test that doesn't apply.
Why they didn't have to grapple with it, because on any reading, that was a misrepresentation of fact, and so they didn't have to deal with the close question as we do here. So maybe you want to deal with this question as a matter of first principles of contract law.
Well, as a matter of contract law, a warranty has to be actionable for its breach to be a breach of a contract. You can't have a contract breach that is based on the breach of an unenforceable warranty within it. Otherwise, the warranty becomes enforceable.
I haven't seen any case that says that a warranty of this sort is unenforceable.
Well, sure. You have the cases of Judge Shader, Judge Holderman, the two decisions below. Before them was Judge Parsons' decision, all of which were contract cases.
None of those are precedential authority here. I'm talking about an appellate decision anywhere that says a warranty of this sort is flatly unenforceable. Let's set aside the reliance question. This is just flatly unenforceable. I don't know of a single case. Maybe you have one.
I think the problem is that we're focusing just on the language. And the cases from both courts, Minnesota and Illinois, teach that you don't just look at the language. You look at the situation to which it's applied. Both courts say that if you can determine the truthfulness of the warranty by just looking at the law, it's a representation of law. If you cannot, because there are latent facts that only the warrantor knows about but you don't, and that's Parkside, it's a representation of fact.
That makes a distinction with a difference in tort cases, because we don't impose tort liability where the duty arises from the law as opposed to the contract by consent of the parties. So it's a legal duty that's imposed on the party by virtue of the circumstances. So that distinction makes a difference in the tort contract, because we don't impose liability for false representations unless there's been a change of position on the part of the plaintiff in reliance on the false representation. And that's why the law-fact distinction is meaningful in the tort context. I'm asking you why it's meaningful in the contract context.
For the simple reason that the law recognizes that that's a burden you cannot allocate.
Why not?
Because that is for you and for your lawyer, unless there is...
Why?
And the Illinois courts say this time and time again, unless there's a fiduciary relationship.
We're in Minnesota law.
I understand that.
Okay.
And I've cited Minnesota cases for the identical proposition.
They're all fraud
cases. The Rasmussen
cases.
Case.
That's a
the
fraud
PA
case.
The PA case from...
That's a fraud case. I'm asking you contract.
The contract case by the Supreme Court.
Parkside, I've already explained to you why it can't be relied on for as much as you're trying to... You're making it do much more work than it can do in this case. So talk to me about first principles of contract law, why this distinction makes a difference in the domain of contract.
Okay. First, if we get to the term itself, the warranty term within the contract, we then get to, and you're right, it was it the Hinckley case, I forget the name of it from the Eighth Circuit, which the Hendricks case, which says that when you're talking about a warranty, and they're not talking about a fraud situation, they're talking about a warranty for it to be enforceable, there has to be reliance.
Why? And what kind of reliance?
There has to be reasonable reliance.
Why? Well, okay.
The Eighth Circuit.
What's wrong with the New York's distinction
New York
between
case,
reliance?
I believe you're referring to the Zip case, was considered by the Hickman case, or Hendricks rather, and they rejected it.
Very short shrift.
Well,
very short shrift.
The Eighth Circuit taking a position about the law in its state over a New York court that has no binding precedent anywhere, it seems to me pretty compelling in terms of at least deference to it. We cited the Jesse case and another case called Vision Bank. The Jesse case not only cited to the Hendricks case in terms of reliance being required for a common law warranty in Minnesota, it cited two other cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court. And they're within the Jesse case. They're right there. So, respectfully, this court does not have the power to say that in a common law warranty in Minnesota, reliance is not required.
Do you think we ought to certify this to the Minnesota Supreme Court?
Judge, I don't think that you should. That issue has not been requested, but I think that before you go against the two decisions from the Supreme Court of Minnesota and the Eighth Circuit,
okay, there's really only one.
Pardon me?
There's really only one, and that's the Midland case.
Well, that's enough.
Right, and that's...
That's better than Zip from New York, I would think.
It's very old, and it hasn't been grappled with by the courts of Minnesota in any significant way in light of the modern understanding of warranty claims, which is that they are situated in contract, not in tort.
But the modern Minnesota cases, and I've just told you about two of them, Vision Bank and Jesse, say that reliance is required in non-UCC cases. One of them was last year. I don't think that's too old.
What kind of reliance, though? Did those cases discuss the distinction between contract formation reliance
in the benefit of the bargain, or
contract performance reliance?
They were both contract/warranty cases. Nothing to do with fraud.
Right.
Nothing at all.
No,
and they said we treat them the same way, a contract case and a warranty case. And if it's enforceable for one, it's enforceable as to both because it's the same theory. And conversely, if it's not, then it's not. But both cases were as plain as a pikestaff that you have to have reliance under Minnesota law in terms of a common law warranty.
Did they address the question that I'm addressing?
Which particular question are we talking about now?
What kind of reliance is necessary, whether it's reliance on this warranty as being part of the bargain at contract formation or reliance in performance, that is to say, reliance on a specific transaction within the contemplation of the contract.
They just say that the warranty has to be relied upon. But to the extent that I think I understand the question that you're making, the Eighth Circuit in Hickman or Hendricks, I keep getting it wrong, wasn't altogether sure that reliance shouldn't also be required under the UCC because the warranty has to be part of the basis for the bargain. And that was its way of saying that even in that circumstance, we think that there has to be reliance.
I think these cases that you're referring to, counsel, really were tort cases. The Vision Bank case was a fraud in the inducement case, which is either a tort or it's an equitable contract remedy seeking rescission of a contract. The remedy for a contract fraudulently induced is rescission because that contract is voidable.
Was a breach of contract case / breach of warranty. There was no fraud or tort involved. All the cases that I've cited from this district were contract cases, and they all recognize that there cannot be a warranty of law. It's just not actionable. No case, and I defy my colleagues to point to one case that says a pure warranty of law is actionable under any setting.
Do you recognize the consequences of the argument that you're making for commercial transactions? I mean, in the mortgage industry alone,
the only consequence is that an expert mortgagor like Lyon has a duty to look at the law. It's filed 20 lawsuits in this building.
So when mortgages are bought and sold in the commercial marketplace, as they routinely are, and are bundled into mortgage-backed securities, as they routinely are, and the contracting parties allocate the risk of loss that one of the mortgages is unenforceable, that is per se an unenforceable warranty? Do you realize how significantly that would disturb contractual expectations and private ordering?
To know the law, but it's never enough to say there's been an allocation. Those cases are talking about situations where you've allocated the burden of undertaking to find out facts to the person who's selling you a piece of property so that they don't have to get a bulldozer in your backyard to see if there's an EPA violative tank buried underneath it, or rip out the walls to see if there are electrical situations that are unsafe or asbestos. That's what that allocation is talking about. No case says that you can allocate the burden of legal homework on the other side, especially when you're a sophisticated party. It doesn't change anything, save for the fact that
it happens every day in the mortgage markets.
Well, this court's decision will, I guess, reinforce that which is clear throughout all of these cases, and that is that parties are charged with learning, knowing, and understanding the law. They can't just sign a contract willy-nilly and say, listen, you tell me what the law is. No case supports that. And if that's the case, not only did Hendricks get it wrong, and the Supreme Court in Parkside get it wrong, Judge Shader got it wrong, Chief Judge Holderman got it wrong, every court that's looked at this issue got it wrong because of, I guess, they missed some concerns or considerations for down the road. RSI, a case decided by Minnesota within the last few weeks, said that a representation of law is just not actionable. Not at all. It's no ground for relief. It doesn't say it's not a contract ground for relief. It's not a fraud ground for relief. It's no ground for relief. Right. That's the Minnesota Appellate Court in 2012.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Babu, your time had expired, but I kept you going beyond your rebuttal time. So if you'd like a couple minutes to rebut.
I will try to be brief. I think Your Honor hit the nail on the head when you indicated that the Minnesota Supreme Court has not indicated how it would rule because of its treatment of the representation issue in Parkside.
What about certification? Should we give them a chance to address this in the first instance?
I don't think so. I think the court can apply the plain meaning rule and look at the representation and indicate the parties allocated the risk to Illinois Paper.
Well, if all we had here was a fact question, I might agree with you, but this is a really, really important legal question about which the court has not pronounced, the Minnesota Supreme Court, that is.
I understand.
And we do have the Eighth Circuit predicting that they would address it in a certain way.
I understand, but I think Your Honor had addressed the point of is the warranty material to contract formation. I think that's the correct way to analyze it. Illinois Paper represented to Lyon that this lease was enforceable. Lyon would not have entered into the contract if that representation was not made by Illinois Paper. Illinois Paper was providing the equipment and the maintenance for the copier equipment and was in the best position to know about the enforceability. So I would say that the court could apply the plain meaning rule and look at the issue of contract formation and if the representation was material to contract formation and address the issue that way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.